The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly with me, Charles Arthur. This week I'm joined by technology and media reporter Josh Halliday. We'll be looking at the eternal smartphone patent wars, with this week's instalment involving Samsung and Apple, as well as Instagram grabbing the right to sell your photos, and some important news about Doc Christmas. I also talked to one of the unsung heroes of the internet, Nathaniel Borenstein, whose MIME email standard is the backbone of how email attachments work to this day. Yes, it's his fault you've got that 20 megabyte attachment of someone's bum taken by the internet-enabled photocopier. Truly, we're in his debt. And one extra feature. Tom Robinson, yes, that Tom Robinson, the musician and radio presenter, challenged us on Twitter to give the history of the mobile phone in three objects. I'll explain why, but if you want to be thinking about how you would represent the history of the mobile phone in three objects, we'll be doing it at the end of the program. This is Tech Weekly from The Guardian. First, Samsung and Apple have moved their patent battle on. In San Jose this morning, Judge Lucy Koh decided that Samsung could not have a retrial of the jury verdict that awarded Apple $1 billion for patent infringement by Samsung. Samsung had alleged that Velvin Hogan, the foreman of the jury, had been biased because in 1993 he was sued by Seagate, in which Samsung is a shareholder, but didn't mention it to the court. The judge threw that out, but she also denied Apple's request for a sales ban on 20 Samsung smartphones that were found to have infringed its patents. Samsung says only three are still on sale in the US, but even so, observers were surprised that Apple could win the patent infringement case, yet be turned down for a sales ban. Then on Tuesday morning, Samsung said it was withdrawing its request for injunctions, that is sales bans, but not the legal cases seeking payment against Apple products in Europe, where standards essential patents were involved. Josh, what do you make of this?
Well, this is the latest, isn't it, in the tangled web of patent battles in the mobile space, and particularly between Apple and Samsung, where things have reached fever pitch. This latest move, the Samsung dropping its attempt for injunctions against Apple, involves so-called standard essential technology for things like wireless communication. There is speculation that Samsung was lent on by the competition regulator, the European Commission, that the European Commission might be behind this because it was, of course, investigating Samsung over whether it unfairly banned competitors from using its patents. We're sure that Samsung wouldn't wanted to drop this this attempt for a sales ban against Apple because it's, you know, another step against it in the long running war. But we can be sure that this won't affect the trial that's going on in London, and Samsung still got sales bans in progress against Apple around the world, including the US, South Korea and Australia. So we can be sure that this is going to continue.
It's quite
interesting. Well into 2013.
It's quite interesting that they dropped the seeking the sales bans in Europe, but not in other places. I mean, I've heard some murmurings that the US, where the Department of Justice is looking into what Samsung is doing with this, that the US may see the same moves by Samsung, that they might stop seeking a sales ban and simply be seeking to get the court cases to go through and to get payment there. Because this seems to be what they're doing, is that they're saying, OK, we don't need the sales ban, but we still want the court case to proceed so that we get paid. And it all seems to come down to these SEPs, Standards Essential Patents, where, in effect, they've agreed to license them, and the dispute is all about how much they should be paid. But they seem to be accepting in Europe, if not yet in other countries, that a judge can decide that if they can't agree it with the other side, which in this case seems to be Apple.
Which is why there is speculation that the European Commission was behind this, because after all, the European Commission is the body, the watchdog, that's in charge of protecting consumers' interests. This will mean that there won't be any ban, well, at least in the near-term future, on Apple products that Samsung have complained about in terms of these standard essential patents. But as you say, it could still reach courts where Samsung will still seek damages. But for the near term, at least in Europe, there won't be any Apple products coming off the shelves in relation to these complaints.
So Apple doesn't get a ban in the US, Samsung doesn't get a ban in Europe. What do we think? Stalemate? A sort of a nothing? Is it a sort of a no one wins sort of situation?
Well, Apple's 1 billion up, isn't it, so far?
But sort of pocket change for Apple, isn't it?
Pocket change, and we've also no idea how much this is costing both companies in terms of the legal costs. Surely there will be astronomical costs involved, and I'm sure that one day we will. Perhaps not for Samsung, because it's a company that files its financial records in the Far East, isn't it? Whereas Apple is obliged to disclose the minutiae of all its financial data with the SEC in America. But this is a stalemate, and it will continue to 2013. Who knows whether it will continue to 2014 as well?
More on these stories as they develop at guardian.co.uk/technology. Facebook's subsidiary Instagram, which it bought for $1 billion in April, has become famous as the service where millions of people put filters on pictures of what they're about to eat. But this week, the company changed its terms so that it could sell those photos and their metadata to advertisers, prompting a storm of outrage on Twitter, deletion of Instagram accounts, and complaints about what had been done. Josh, did we expect this to happen?
I think we did. I mean, there was a huge furore on Twitter when Instagram was bought by Facebook, when the 1 billion deal was announced, with dozens, hundreds of Instagram users saying they would abandon the service after it was bought by Facebook and evil Mark Zuckerberg. This is the latest in that, really, in that saga. Generally, users of free services like Instagram and Twitter do not like having fresh restrictions imposed on them after they've already started enjoying the service. But one thing is for sure, this time next week, people will have been uploading vast amounts of pictures of their Christmas presents and Christmas dinners, which could be used by Tesco or Marks and Spencer's or
well,
Apple.
Yeah, I've got to say that the people who seem like they'd benefit best would be advertisers looking to do pictures of food, because that and sort of snowscapes and possibly pictures of bridges. That's mostly what I see on Instagram, I think. Or are you thinking too narrowly about it?
No, that's right. I mean, the changes to these terms does essentially mean that Facebook/Instagram will be able to hand these pictures to companies for use in their advertisements. But there's no indication that Facebook wants to do that, other than that it's changed the legal detail of the terms so that it can do that if needs be. Would it make financial sense for Facebook to flog these pictures for $1 a pop to companies when, the trust issue is huge for Facebook, clearly?
So who do you think benefits out of this? I mean, you went along to the launch of a new Flickr mobile app the other day. Do you think that Flickr can benefit from this?
Flickr could benefit from this in the short term, because it had the PR boost last week of launching a new mobile app for Flickr, which had languished, as we've spoken about before on this podcast, against rivals like Instagram and the rest of them. Will people move over to Flickr immediately overnight because of this Instagram change? I don't think so. It's more of a long-term thing. It's a short-term explosion of outrage on Twitter. But tomorrow morning people wake up and will be still using Instagram, and it takes a lot of effort and time to transfer all your habit from one service to another, where your library of pictures are, all your friends are. It's not something that you can do overnight.
There's a sort of joke I saw online, which is a million people walk into a Silicon Valley bar, nobody buys anything, the bar is declared a roaring success, which seems to sort of describe this a bit. Is there a sort of golden rule that people should keep in mind about free services?
Well, you are the product on a free service, aren't you? The whole idea of people using Facebook, Instagram and Twitter is that it's free and they are there to be monetized. They are there to be made money out of, and these companies can change their terms and services liberally, as they have done throughout recent history. And if you care about the service that much, you need to look for one that you pay for. Otherwise, these are the terms that you have to accept.
Josh, thanks very much. Now, at this time of year, everyone is familiar with Roy Wood's Wizards singing about how they wish it could be Christmas every day. And of course, Live Aid ask whether people know it's Christmas. But on the web, there's some interesting news for Mr. Wood. Josh, explain.
So Christmas is cancelled, at least for 2014, because the new...
Roy Wood's going to be upset.
Roy Wood will be upset. He won't be getting his
royalties.
Royalties payout this year quite yet. Or next year, in fact, because .Christmas, the new top-level domain, or generic top-level domain, as people wish it to be called, will not be online until late 2014 after an auction that was held by ICANN in Los Angeles on Monday night, which very few of the media seem to be interested in. But it's a huge event that will change the face of the web and how we all use it, because, you know, this time in 2 years, in the run-up to Christmas 2014, we will be visiting websites like, you know, hoodies.christmas and snoods.christmas and, you know, and crackers.christmas and what have you. But it's just a shame that it couldn't launch next year, when the first batch of these new domains will go online, expected from April next year.
So just to remind us what ICANN is and why it is that .christmas has been pushed through to 2014.
ICANN is the body that's governing the process for the rollout of these new domain names to rival .co.uk and .com. And it said it will only launch 1,000 domain names a year. Essentially, that's as much as the internet can handle at one time. It's expected that it will only be able to put about 750 online next year, the vast majority of which are Chinese and Japanese new top-level domain names because of...
And .Christmas came out too far down the list, did it?
That's right. .Christmas came out something like 1,240, so it narrowly missed out on being in the first batch of 1,000. It's expected that, because there's been hiccups throughout this process, it will push it back through 2013 and, you know, mid to late 2014, we might finally see it online. But it's a big loss for old Roy Wood and his content.
What's the benefit of having a .Christmas domain? I mean, you sort of mentioned, you know, that you could go to hoodie.christmas or snoo.christmas, but why would one want to have a sort of generic thing like that when you can go to, you know, amazon.com or argos.com or, you know, actual stores that you know the name of?
What's interesting and fascinating about this whole process is that no one really knows how it's going to work, because it's never happened before. Essentially, .Christmas will be a new corner of the internet, like a Santa's grotto of the internet, confined to all things festive and all things Christmas and seasonal. So it's very clear what people will be going to looking for when they visit a .Christmas website. They might not use Google anymore. For example, you know, if they want to look for Christmas jumpers, they might go straight to jumpers.christmas if some lucky company has snapped that URL up. So it will be interesting to see how users' habits change because of these new internet domains, but really no one knows how it works at the minute.
I mean, we've got a limited example with the .xxx top-level domain, haven't we, which was launched sort of last year. That doesn't seem to have impinged on many people's consciousness, or do I just frequent the wrong places?
I can't claim to have any experience in the success of these .xxx sites, but I assume .xxx has been one of those domains which has been, you know, really hotly competed for, like .music and .news and .book, which has seen Google and Amazon go head-to-head. And the thing about those domains, .book, .news and .music, is that they won't go live for a long, long time, because there's disputes to be resolved which could end up in a highest bidder wins auction somewhere down the line, of which the proceeds all go conveniently to ICANN. So that will be a huge, huge thing to look out for in the near-term future.
As ever, catch up with the news at guardian.co.uk/technology. Now, Nathaniel Borenstein is an American computer scientist who in the early 1990s was one of the team at Bell Communications Research, working on making email into something much more useful. He came up with the MIME standard, which formatted multimedia such as images and allowed him to send the first email attachment. Since then, he's gone on to work with IBM, found the first cyberbank called First Virtual Holdings, and today is the chief scientist at the email management company Mimecast. So it was a delight to have Nathaniel in the Tech Weekly studios to discuss his role in email technology, but also to discuss the ever-present problem of spam and the more important one of how to make email work for, not against you. Welcome, Nathaniel. Just give us the potted recap of your internet history, because it's actually quite distinguished.
Oh, well, yes, thanks. It's good to be here. I've been working on internet technology for 100,000 years in binary. I love to say that. That's 32 years in decimal. Most of that has been devoted to email. I always found email to be a technology that liberated people to live in ways they couldn't without it. In my own case, I have worked from home in the woods of Michigan most of that 32 years, and without email, it would not have been possible. Along the way, I've developed a number of email systems and technologies and innovations related to email, the best known of which is the MIME standard, which is the way that we include anything other than plain English text in email messages.
So when did MIME first start to be needed? When did you, because obviously this predates the web, when did you first notice that actually something was needed?
Well, actually, what happened was in the late 1980s, I worked on a system called the Andrew Mail System, which was the first widely used system that let people include pictures and sounds and such in email. And after that had become well enough known to attract a stream of visitors to Carnegie Mellon, where I was at the time, one of those visitors was Steve Jobs. And he came along and saw the system and immediately tried to hire the whole team. Now, none of us wanted to be hired by Steve Jobs at the time. This was while he had Next Computers was his company. So he started a company, and he started a project within Next to build a similar multimedia mail tool. And that was fine, you know, imitation is the sincerest form of flattery and all that. But once it hit the market, it was striking that his users could send pictures to each other, and my users could send pictures to each other, but his users and my users could not interchange pictures. And that really underscored the need for a standard. Now, at the same time, email was spreading rapidly beyond the English-speaking world, and there were a lot of problems involved in the sort of ad hoc ways that people were representing non-English characters. So those two things, plus some problems around email gatewaying, all came together to motivate what became the MIME standard.
How long did it take to come up with the MIME standard? How long did it get to, you know, take to really get that to be a standard?
About 2 years, which is actually quite fast for a standard of that kind. And it reflects the fact that there was a very strong need for it and that the people involved were, for the most part, remarkably reasonable. My experience since has been that's not always the case.
Steve Jobs being reasonable?
Well, he wasn't involved in the standard.
Oh, okay. So that's
actually, there's a funny funny story about Steve Jobs and the standard, which is a couple years after the incident I described, the Next folks were involved in MIME, in discussions leading to MIME, not Steve Jobs, of course, but they were unhappy with one of the decisions that was made. I won't go into the technical details because it's probably not worth doing here, but basically they lost the decision for what I still believe were very good reasons. But Steve Jobs called me up at my home in northern Michigan to try and, I guess, lobby is the polite term for a change. Browbeat might be another term. And it just so happened that he called when I was off in the woods cutting trees, and my wife put Steve Jobs on hold for about 15 minutes while she got me, which is still one of her proudest moments.
So you were able to say, I'm holding an axe, if you know.
Basically, yes.
That's great. And other companies that you've worked with, you've been at First Virtual, which was a sort of a electronic payment system, though you said it's before, predated eBay and PayPal, so mm-hmm. So in effect it was a sort of payment system that you couldn't use to pay anything for anything. another one called NetPOS, you've worked at IBM. You're now with Mimecast. What does Mimecast do? What are their objectives? What's the problems that you're trying to solve?
Well, Mimecast looks at email as a business tool and ask the question, what can we do to make it more useful and less painful for business to be transacted by email? And it turns out that there's a lot of green space there because there's a lot of things people like about email, and most people in business are heavily dependent on email. But when you ask them, there's also a lot of dissatisfaction. And the dissatisfaction has led to some people saying, oh, we're going to move towards social media, or we're going to cut down on email some other way. And it doesn't seem to work very well because the basic notion of store and forward messages is really useful to business. So we're looking at all the auxiliary things and trying to streamline, first of all, the administration of auxiliary email services, and then trying to find the places where email is weakest and supplement it with things that take away some of the pain. So we call that unified email management.
Is what you're describing there, I mean, store and forward for email, yes, there's a virtue in that, one can see. But equally, you could look at things like Facebook or Yammer, which is a sort of corporate version of Twitter, or things like Google Docs, you could say, well, these are actually a sort of store and forward. Google Docs is a store and access, store and multiple access. And in that respect, it has the sort of benefits that you can look for out of email, except you don't get replication. You don't have the sort of the needless multiple sort of botherments of it. Is what you're describing trying to make a very old tool do something in a modern world where actually there are many other ways to do it?
Well, I think there are aspects of email that are old, but the basic idea of asynchronously delivering messages to you is sort of timeless. It's unlikely that people will stop appreciating that. And the problem with thinking in terms of doing that in other tools is the one of notifications and what you have to check. So, for example, I'm a reasonably heavy Facebook user. I've been trying to cut back. But when something comes up on Facebook that is that meets my notification requirements, how do I find out? I get email. And that's because I have not decided that I'm going to reliably check Facebook several times a day to see what's waiting. Now, you could choose anything, in some sense, to be the thing you check frequently and then have everything else send to that. But email happens to be the easiest to do that with still, because nearly any of these services have the facility of sending notification by email. So it's sort of a collection point. It's like saying, you don't need that mailbox outside of your house because we can have lots of companies that put up mailboxes all over town for you. Okay, well, that's not really as convenient.
And I suppose the other thing, I mean, I can see the point about, for example, large stockbrokers or whatever might want to be able to say, we need to know who's been emailing, we need to know, what goes in and out, because it's very important for compliance. For the average person, though, who's not, for example, laboring under the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, mm-hmm. Email tends to be overwhelming. Isn't there a tendency? I mean, I certainly noticed myself. There's a tendency for email simply to get out of hand very easily, very quickly, that so much email comes in, even after spam. And, of course, spam is a separate question. But it becomes impossible to manage in a way that's effective.
Yeah, I think we all live, all of us who use email frequently, live on the ragged edge of being overwhelmed. I think there's a common sense of that, and I feel it too. And to some extent, it's self-limiting. You stop subscribing to things, or you stop taking on new correspondence when you get to the point where you can't do anymore. But it does point, to my mind, to one of the places where email can be supplemented or improved, which is for group communication, large group communication. So when I hear people say that perhaps social media will supplant email, I just try to be respectful and not laugh too hard. But if someone suggests that social media might supplant mailing lists, I think there's a lot of reason to that, because mailing lists have always been one of the least effective, most cumbersome uses of email. And when you set up something like a Facebook group or a Google Plus group, you can do things that are more efficient. Now, we have some real problems with that today. Most of the social networking systems that are in common use aren't designed for business and don't have the privacy characteristics that business requires. Then there are the systems, as you mentioned, like Yammer, that are social networking designed for business. And they, to my mind, have mostly not gotten it quite right. I think they've built something that is a little too separate from email to be as useful as people would want. So one of the many things we're looking at Mimecast right now is trying to find a sort of sweet spot between email and social networking and build something there that will have the best parts of both. And we're not quite there yet, but we're working on it.
Tell us your secrets then. You've been using email for all this time. You live out in the woods in Michigan with your axe in one hand and your computer in the other. What are your secrets then for making sure that your email doesn't just go horrendously out of hand?
Well, first of all, I should say that every time I come up with a new secret or trick to do that, what it seems to let me do is process more mail. And so I end up being just on that ragged edge again, and perhaps more efficiently so, but still having the problem. So one thing I do that I think is illustrative is most of the mailing lists that I subscribe to, I don't send directly to my email address. I send it to another email address that accumulates it all and once a day forwards it. So it comes, I get up in the morning, I check my mail, and all this stuff is there. But once I'm done with it, it doesn't bother me for the rest of the day. And especially for group conversations, that's good because, you know, there's a lot of duplication there too. And if you process it all at once, it's faster. So that allows me, for example, to subscribe to mailing lists on internet standards that are literally in the hundreds of messages a day. And that's, you know, just a piece of my regular mail flow. It might be overwhelming if I got it one at a time, but coming into 150 such messages in the morning, I can go through pretty fast. Another thing that I try very hard to do and mostly fail at is follow the zero inbox philosophy, where you try to get everything out of your inbox as soon as possible. The number of days I've succeeded in that is zero. However, if you don't think of it as a zero inbox philosophy and think of it as a game where you're trying to get the number as low as you can,
right,
it's actually quite useful. I can tell you that my mental health is great when I get under 30 for that number. At the moment I'm traveling, it's gone over 50. I'm getting a little uncomfortable because I keep wondering what's up at the top of that list that I'm not seeing.
You know? So do you use a particular program? You know, is there some sort of super ninja email program that we can all use? Do you deploy lots of filters? Do you read things threaded or flat? How, you know, what are the best ways of doing this?
Well, first of all, I don't know of any really super ninja programs. I tend to use a mail.app on the Macintosh, mostly out of habit. As it turns out, I mentioned that Nextmail was an imitation of the program I wrote in the 80s. It evolved into the current mail.app, so it actually feels very comfortable. It feels like I've been using the same program evolving for about 30 years, nearly.
Right.
So that's inertia as much as wanting to tell you it's the best program. However, I certainly use filters very heavily. I already mentioned the slowdown that I apply. Mm-hmm. I also have probably 20 different inboxes that I filter things into. So, for example, I can easily tend to all my Mimecast-related mail before I deal with anything else. Or my family is also very easy to pick out from the rest. So I think that's very helpful because otherwise you're constantly changing contexts.
This is using the sort of smart mailbox thing that the mail program has, where you can say if it comes from this sender or if it has this subject or things.
Yes,
like that.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And there have been studies, by the way, that show that the thing that costs you is not so much the raw number of messages, although obviously each one is some incremental work, but it's the number of times you change context. So somebody who's still reading their mailbox in linear order, so now they're dealing with mail and now with family and now with something else, they're doing this mental context change that is actually quite expensive in the way we think. That's why interruptions are more of a problem than you might think. I interrupt you to ask you a quick question. It'll often cost you 5 minutes to get back to where you were. And the same happens with mail that's not well sorted. So I think that's an important trick for anybody who's not using it.
Flat or threaded?
I mostly use it flat, but and this points to where I think things are needed. I will switch to a threaded approach for a long conversation sometimes, either on a mailing list or not, most often on a mailing list. So if the context is small, if there have only been four things in this list, I don't really feel I need the threaded discussion. But the more complex the discussion, the more I'm going to need it. And now we're into that territory where I said email starts to be less efficient and less loved when you do surveys. And we've been doing a series of surveys at Mimecast, which we call the Shape of Email, trying to find out what people are doing and what they enjoy, what they think is efficient, and the opposite. And it seems pretty clear that mailing lists and large group mail are among the least popular uses of email, and probably because they're the least effective.
Because they're sort of attention toxic. They just swallow up time inefficiently.
That's right. And the more people that are involved, the more likely it is that people are going to chime in with a whole message. You know, you at least have to click on it that says something essentially "me too," which is not a very productive use of your time. And it'd be much better if you were looking at one comprehensive site or archive or whatever that had them all together, and you could just glance through and see, oh, me too, me too, me too. That's just there are more efficient ways to do it.
It sounds a bit like the sort of things that used to be available, or still are available, but it's useless, on Usenet, where you had lots of news readers where you could simply filter people out. You could say, or subjects out, and you could say, just never show me things from this person. They're never any use. And it sounds like, I've always wondered why mail hasn't quite evolved into something, you know, email readers haven't quite evolved in the way that the news readers often were, where you could class people, and it was easy to class people like that.
Well, you can, if you use the filtering tools like the kind we just discussed. Mm. Fewer people probably do because they're so idiosyncratic, they're different for each mail reader. But I actually have had a small number of people in my career who mail from them went straight to the garbage. Because I just, you know, life is too short to read mail from that person. But it's less likely an email because, unlike net news, it's all at least roughly targeted towards you. And net news is just anyone who's interested in X, and it can be very, very poorly defined. So the tools are there, but they're less useful in general, and they're more idiosyncratic based on the mail reader. So those two combined make it seem like they're less used.
So we've been using email for umpty-ump years. Where do you see it being in 5 years, 10 years? Will it still be as crucial as it feels like it is now?
I certainly think that if you define email as store and forward electronic messaging, it's not going away. If you define it in terms of particular protocols or programs, it may evolve in ways that allow you to say, it's something different in the future. Even that, I doubt, is going to happen anytime soon. What I do think is going to happen is we're going to start to see, as I said before, a bit of a blending between email and social networking that meets the needs of business and takes some of the burden off the inbox. I think we're going to see one of the most interesting things that's going on right now, and that's very painful for implementers, is internationalized email addresses. For those of us in the English-speaking world, it sounds like a yawner. But if your name is only written in Chinese characters, at some point you're going to say, why can't I put my name on the headers too? So that has been standardized and is in the process of being implemented around the world. There will be a lot of glitches around that, almost inevitably. So that's one of the things that's certainly coming.
Glitches due to mail servers not being able to process the headers,
or mail readers. Mm. Mail readers probably more likely because they change more slowly, and people are more likely to be running an ancient version. And the glitches there will probably just be of the form the from field looks like garbage, looks just a bunch of random characters. But you could have programs just, you know, exiting, you know, quitting, crashing. Mm. So, you know, we're in for some transitional times there. Another thing that's going on that is somewhat invisible to users but very important to administrators is domain-level email authentication, which is the next step in the fight against phishing and, to a lesser extent, spam. There are standards now that allow you to know with a much higher degree of confidence that email came from the domain it claims to come from. And that allows you to do some things against spam, but primarily it allows you to cut off a lot of phishing attempts.
This is stuff rather like SPF.
Actually, SPF is a similar technology. Well, yes, it's one of those technologies. I was thinking more of the cryptographic technologies like DKIM, mm-hmm. And DMARC, which is built around DKIM and SPF. SPF is built around IP addresses. So there you would say any mail from Citibank came from these IP addresses, mm. Whereas with DKIM you'd say any mail from Citibank would be signed with these keys. And they have enough different strengths and weaknesses that the DMARC effort is trying to incorporate both of them into a larger set of practices that allows cooperating mail senders and receivers to go a long way towards eliminating that kind of phishing. But it's never going to go away because I can register a domain called sitonebank.com, where I just replace an I with a one, and then I can myself sign it in ways that I absolutely guarantee it comes from sitonebank.com, and some people are going to think it's Citibank. So we can cut down on the number of successful frauds, but there's always going to be attempts and some successful ones.
Nathaniel Borenstein of Mimecast, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Now, I mentioned at the top of the show that Tom Robinson of Six Music and 2468 Motorway fame had challenged us on Twitter because he tweets us at Freshnet, and he tweeted a picture from Denmark Street, which is also known as Timpan Alley in London, a picture of a gold-top Gibson guitar from 1956, an orange amplifier, which I think dates from the 70s or so, and a drum synthesizer. And I commented that this was sort of the history of music in one photo. These three objects pretty much showed where we'd gone to in the last sort of 40, 50 years. And he came back and challenged me and said, so, okay, the history of mobile phones in three objects. Can you do that on Guardian Tech Weekly? So here's my stab at it. I'd say I wouldn't actually go with the very first mobile phone, the Motorola one, the giant brick, because I think that's a bit too obvious. Actually, I'd say to start with the Nokia 6310i, which is it's a sort of cylindrical shaped. You know the shape of the iconic Nokia phone. It actually dates to 2002. I happen to know, and here's a music connection, that Bob Geldof keeps a store of these because that's the only phone that he can bear to have. He doesn't want to have email. He doesn't want anything else. He doesn't want to make phone calls and perhaps send a text message. So there you go, Tom. There's a piece of information for you. The second iconic one, well, I think it has to be the original iPhone from 2007. It wasn't a great phone in many ways, but it was the one that really kicked off the revolution and got everyone thinking about the whole idea of the phone, of the smartphone as a mobile computer and of the full touchscreen. And I think as my final object, I would take from 2012, the Samsung Galaxy Note 2 with a sort of 5-inch screen. It's even got a little pen, though I don't think the pen is fantastically useful. But the thing I think is fascinating about it is that it's got all the capabilities. It's got a big screen for looking at things, you know, if you really want to take the web around with you. But equally, it's got things like S-Voice, so you can drive it with your voice. You don't actually have to look at it. You can just put it in a pocket, say in a jacket or something, use your headphones or the mic, and that is the whole smartphone revolution there in your pocket. So there you go. That's me answering the question of the mobile phones. But we're really interested to hear your views. How would you depict the history of mobile phones in three objects? Send us your tweets at GuardianTW, and we'll pick out the best ones and try to feature them on the feed. Well, that's all we have for you this week. We'll be back during the holiday period with our roundup of the big tech stories of 2012. But until then, I'll say thank you to Josh Halliday and to tech producer Jason Phipps. I'm Charles Arthur. Thank you for listening, and goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.